Adolf Eichmann nimtza kvar b'matzar ba'aretz.
Adolf Eichmann is a prisoner in Israel. With these words spoken before Israel's parliament on a sunny May afternoon in 1960, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion informed the world that a 15-year search had ended, that the man accused of engineering the deaths of 6 million Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe had been brought to the bar of justice in Jerusalem. Who was this man and what did he actually do? The world began to learn the answers to these questions on April 11th, 1961. A clerk called the court to order. Three black-robed judges filed in, and the trial of Adolf Eichmann began. Eichmann himself, a balding, slim, stooped figure, sat in a glass-walled cage built to protect him against possible assassination.
Adolf Eichmann. Ata Adolf, b'no shel Adolf Karl Eichmann.
Are you Adolf, the son of Adolf Karl Eichmann? Eichmann, standing ramrod straight, replied,
Jawohl.
The presiding judge, Dr. Moshe Landau, then read a 15-count indictment.
Zehu ktav ha'ishum negdecha, mitam ha'yoetz ha'mishpati la'memshala.
The indictment listed crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, war crimes, and membership in illegal Nazi organizations. Then the chief counsel for the defense, Dr. Robert Savatius, moved to have the case dismissed. He challenged the competency of the court on many grounds, but the core of his argument was contained in these two sentences.
Sie betreffen die Besorgnis der Befangenheit der Richter und die Unzuständigkeit des Gerichts.
I wish, said Servatius, to voice two reservations, the suspicion of prejudice and the lack of authority of this court. The legal argument which followed was settled by a ruling read by Judge Landau.
The court will now hand down the following decision, decision number 3. Regarding the fears of the accused as to the background against which this case is to be conducted, indeed it is true that the memory of the catastrophe and the Holocaust stirs the heart of every Jew. But this case having now been brought before us, it is our bounden duty to restrain even those feelings when we sit in judgment in this case. And this duty we shall keep. After weighing all arguments brought by the learned counsel for the defense, the court finds itself, and each judge finds himself, fit to sit in judgment.
Following this, Eichmann was asked to plead guilty or not guilty.
Im Sinne der Anklage, nicht schuldig.
15 times he was asked, once for each count, and each time he replied, not guilty in the sense of the indictment. With that, the prosecution opened its case against Adolf Eichmann.
When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors. But alas, they cannot rise to level the finger of accusation in the direction of the glass dock and cry out, J'accuse, against the man who sits there. Because their ashes have been piled up in the mounds of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka, or spilled into the rivers of Poland, and their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries to heaven, but their voice cannot be heard. Thus it falls to me to be their spokesman and to deliver the heinous accusation in their name.
Chief Prosecutor Gideon Hausner's opening address lasted for 2 days. In 50,000 words, he traced the rise of the Nazi movement in Germany, and with it the progression from the first anti-Semitic laws of 1933 to the so-called final solution of the Jewish problem, the physical slaughter of every Jew in Europe. Through it all, there strode the figure of Adolf Eichmann, first an SS man in Austria, then a jailer at the Dachau concentration camp, later the official in charge of the expulsion of Jews from Germany and the confiscation of their property, after that appearances in Austria and Czechoslovakia in the same role, still later the Gestapo officer in charge of Jewish problems, and finally, throughout Europe, the director of the apparatus through which millions of people were butchered by the most scientific and efficient means ever developed. Hausner concluded his review of Eichmann's career with these words.
We shall prove that even after the downfall of the Nazi monster, when the entire world had expressed its shock and horror at what had happened, when a number of the Nazi leaders themselves had begun in panic-stricken haste and ostensible penitence to expose and accuse one another, even then, he, Adolf Eichmann, remained faithful to his ideas and principles. He did not repent. He still believes that he did what was right and proper in destroying millions. He knows that today it is regarded as a crime, and he will therefore be ready to give verbal and insincere expression to this view. At times, he may even clothe it with a mantle of grandiloquent phrases. But we have every reason to believe that if the swastika flag were again to be raised with shouts of Sieg Heil, if there were again to resound the hysterical screams of a Führer, if again the high-tension barbed wires of extermination centers were set up, Adolf Eichmann would rise, salute, and go back to his work of oppression and butchery.
The prosecution then began presenting witnesses to support its case. There were many Jews who testified on meetings with Eichmann in the days before the war, when he was considered the Nazis' foremost expert on problems of emigration. But one witness was not a Jew. He was a Christian, Dean Heinrich Gruber of a German evangelical church, who took it upon himself to aid the Jewish people in their time of trouble, and who paid for his efforts with imprisonment in a concentration camp.
The impression he made on me was that of a man who sits there like a block of ice or of marble. We used to call this the type of a Landsknecht, as it were. We distinguish between soldiers and mercenaries. A mercenary, a Landsknecht, is one who doffs his conscience and his powers of reason the moment he dons his uniform. And this was the impression he made not only on me, but also on my collaborators and friends.
There were also those who met Eichmann in the early days of the war, when he was just beginning to take an active interest in methods other than emigration for solving the Jewish problem. Max Berger lived in a small town in Czechoslovakia. In September 1939, the Jews of his community were shipped by the SS to Poland.
The speech was roughly as follows. About 7 or 8 kilometers from here, across the River San, the Führer has promised the Jews a new homeland. There are no apartments and no houses. If you build, you will have a roof over your heads. There's no water. The wells are full of epidemics. There's cholera, dysentery, and typhus. If you dig for water, you will have water. This speech was made by Adolf Eichmann.
Adolf Eichmann was rising to the top of his chosen profession. In January 1942, he and his superior officer, SS General Heinrich Müller, commander of the Gestapo, attended the Wannsee Conference in Berlin, at which were drawn up the plans for the final solution. He was placed at the head of the Gestapo Office 4B4, the bureau which dealt with Jewish matters, and from then on he was master of the fate of European Jewry. His position was described to the court by Judge Michael Musmano of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, who after the war was assigned by the American Navy to investigate whether or not Adolf Hitler was actually dead. In the course of his investigations, Judge Musmano kept hearing the name of Adolf Eichmann.
Schellenberg was very close to Hitler. He said that Eichmann was subordinate only to Heydrich, and that then when Kaltenbrunner succeeded Heydrich, Eichmann usually bridged over Kaltenbrunner and went to Himmler. When Kaltenbrunner then took over, he was reluctant to limit the authority of Eichmann, whom he had known as a boyhood friend in Linz. And thus Eichmann continued to dominate the entire Jewish extermination program emanating from the RSHA.
Having established Eichmann's position within the Nazi hierarchy, the prosecution set out to show what his responsibility meant as regards the fate of the Jews of Europe.
Everybody got a shovel and we started to dig our own grave. When the grave was finished, two worked down the grave, had to lay down with side by side with their faces down and were shot. The next two had to cover a little sand over the first two and lay down in the other direction, line by line, and were shot again, and so it went ahead.
That was Leon Wells, now of Fort Lee, New Jersey, but born in Poland, now a scientist in America, but once a child whose youth was spent in concentration camps. He was one of the fortunate who survived. There were many children who did not. 1.5 million children.
He got to La Rova Schlageto.
I reached the ghetto quarter, and when I arrived at a certain street, suddenly a woman ran towards us, holding a little girl in her arms. What I gathered from her was that she and the girl, who looked about 3 years old, had been hiding in a little cave in the wall for more than 11 months. At that moment, the girl opened her mouth and said, "Mama, may one cry now?" And the mother told me that for these 11 months, day in and day out, she had told the girl that she shouldn't cry when she was hungry for fear that someone heard this outside and discovered them.
I saw mothers who shouted, a mother whose three children had been taken away. She went up to this truck and shouted to the German, give me the children. And he said, how many have you got? She said, three. And the German said, you may have one. And she went up into that truck and all three children craned their necks. Of course, each of the three wanted to go with the mother. And the mother could not choose, so she went down on her own and left the truck alone.
Mostly children survived. These were little children who were lying close to the floor. When we opened the gas chambers and removed the bodies, we saw the children down on the floor alive, and the Germans took them out and shot them.
I remember one case of a boy. He was 10 years old. He had been locked up for one whole year in a small room. He had not been allowed to raise his voice, so the neighbors shouldn't hear him. When he came to Westerbork, he still spoke in a whisper. And when he was told it was no longer necessary, when he understood that he was now allowed to do all this, he started running around the children's yard very fast. He ran all the time. He couldn't stop. And he shouted at the top of his voice because for a whole year he had not been permitted to walk or speak above a whisper. 3 days later, he was sent to Auschwitz.
Auschwitz. There, the Nazi genius for the organization of death came to full flower. 2.5 million souls perished there. What was Auschwitz? The inhabitants of that planet had no names. They had no parents. And they had no children. They were not clothed as we are clothed here. They were not born there, and they did not conceive there. They breathed and lived according to different laws of nature. They did not live according to the laws of this world of ours. Their name was
Katsetnik,
the inmate of a concentration camp. The name taken by this particular witness after he survived Auschwitz and began to write books about his experiences, House of Dolls, Pipel, and other works. The planet Auschwitz, which he described, had many satellites, Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, Chelmno, and others which were scattered over all of Europe. And in each of these, the process of slaughter was developed to the highest peak of efficiency.
People arrived from that notorious Himmelstrasse, gateway to heaven, which led from camp number one to camp number two. SS men were posted all the way of that gateway to heaven, all the staff of camp too. They had dogs, whips, they had bayonets in their hands. People walked calmly. They did not know where they were being led. When they entered the gas chambers, two Ukrainians stood near the entrance. One was Ivan, the other was Nikolai. They turned on the gas. And since the last to enter already saw what was happening, they did not wish to enter, and they had to be jammed inside, 400 into the small chamber. It was difficult to close the doors. And when the doors were locked, we were on the outside. We heard some screams, Shema Israel, mother, father. And after 35 minutes, they were all dead. Two Germans were standing there, and they said, all is asleep. Open the doors. And we opened the doors and we took the bodies out.
The bodies were scientifically disposed of.
The job was to erase any sign of the murdering of the people by the Nazis. Make up pyres and burn these bodies, grind the bones, pick out all the valuables in the ashes, like gold teeth, rings, and so on, separate them. After grinding the bones, we used to put out the ashes so nobody can recognize whenever it was their grave.
And nothing went to waste.
At times, we took ashes from crematorium number 3 after the bodies had been burned. It was winter time, and we had to put ashes on the roads against the frost so that people could walk on the road without slipping.
And where was Adolf Eichmann while this was taking place? The commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Hess, wrote before his execution in 1946 a statement in which he described the inner workings of the planet he ruled. Much of his statement was introduced by the prosecution.
My instructions were as follows. As a matter of principle, all those who arrived in Eichmann's transports were to be exterminated. And this operation of his brooked no delay, not even for a single hour. When the first transports reached Auschwitz, Eichmann himself arrived with them. Eichmann personally supervised these transports, and he set the date for these people to be sent to the gas chambers.
Dieter Wislicini, one of Eichmann's chief lieutenants, also left behind a statement when he was executed for war crimes.
I spoke to Eichmann in his office in Berlin, and he told me the Jews would be exterminated according to a written order from Himmler. These are the important things in that letter. The Führer decided that we must start immediately with the final solution of the Jewish problem. Eichmann told me that the words, the final solution, meant a biological extermination of the Jewish race. I was impressed with this document, giving Eichmann the authority to kill millions of people, and I said at the time, God forbid that someday our enemies do the same to the German nation. He replied, don't be sentimental. This is the order of the Führer.
Eichmann was all-powerful. He was even strong enough to play with his victims. A peppery, red-haired man named Joel Brunn took the witness stand one day and told what may well have been the most fantastic story of World War II.
Zwischen Vorzimmer und Zimmer in der Türöffnung stand ein
There was an anteroom and a room, and in the doorway there was a table. I reached as far as the table. Eichmann was standing there in front of the table, his legs apart and his hands on his hips. And he bawled. Do you know who I am? I'm in charge of the operation. And then he said, Europe, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, the operation was through. Now came the turn of Hungary. He said that he had called me to suggest a business transaction. That he was ready to sell me 1 million Jews. Goods against money. Money against goods. 10,000 trucks. 100 Jews for one truck. You're getting it very cheap, he said. That was the tone of his voice then. What do you want to save? Women capable of bearing children? Or men who can create them? He could not give me more than 1 million, perhaps at a later stage.
The plan, if it was ever intended seriously, didn't work out, and the slaughter continued. The numbers grew to such an extent that the mind refused to comprehend them. Occasionally, in the experiences of a single survivor, something of the magnitude of the tragedy impressed itself upon those listening in the courtroom. One need only multiply this instance by 6 million.
Mein Kind hat mir gesagt, stehen die Kinder im Ghetto. Sagt sie mir, Mami, er fast noch mal angetan, die Scheibe ist dicke Sache, mit Füchter und Schießen.
While we were lined up in the ghetto, my child said, Mother, why did you make me wear the Shabbat dress? We are being taken to be shot.
Man will bei einem Grub stehen, die kurz mir rechert. Wo stehe ich mir um erwarten? Komm mir an das Leben.
And when we stood near the dugout, near the grave, she said, Mother, what are we waiting for? Let us run. I turned my head and he asked, who do you want me to shoot first? I did not answer. I did not answer. I felt him take the child from my arms. The child cried out for the last time and was shot immediately. And then he aimed at me. Then he held on to my hair and turned my head around. I remained standing. I heard a shot and fell. I fell into the grave but felt nothing. At the moment, I did feel, I felt a sort of heaviness. And then I thought, maybe I am not alive anymore, but I feel something after death. I thought I was dead, that this was the feeling which comes after death. Then I felt that I was choking, people falling over me. I was drowning. I tried to move and felt that I was alive and that I could rise. I was strangling, but I fought on. Suddenly I felt that I was rising, I was climbing towards the top of the grave. I saw people clutching at my legs. I felt bodies pulling at me with their hands, biting, pulling me down, down. I did not know the place. I wanted to see the end of the stretch of dead bodies, but I could not.
There
were terrible voices, naked, shot but not dead, children crying, mother, father. I entered the dead. I prayed for the grave to open and take me in alive. Thought maybe this would happen. I cried out, mother, father, did I sin so heavily to deserve this torture?